Welcome to SCOTUScast, Capital Punishment and Recusal Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 29, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Williams v. Pennsylvania. Terrence Williams was convicted and sentenced to death for the robbery and murder of Amos Norwood. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania affirmed Williams' conviction and sentence, and his initial attempts to obtain state post-conviction relief failed. His subsequent petition for federal habeas relief also failed. He again sought post-conviction penalty-related relief in state court, and prevailed in the Court of Common Pleas on a claim of unlawful evidence suppression. On appeal, however, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court reversed the grant of relief and lifted the stay of execution, though a temporary reprieve was later granted by the governor for other reasons. The Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Ronald Castile, who had joined the opinion reversing the grant of relief to Williams, had also been the district attorney for Philadelphia during Williams' trial, sentencing, and appeal. In that capacity, Castile had authorized his office to seek the death penalty for Williams. Williams had moved to have Chief Justice Castile recuse himself from hearing the appeal of post-conviction relief, but Castile declined to do so. The question now before the U.S. Supreme Court is twofold. 1. Whether the 8th and 14th Amendments are violated where a state Supreme Court justice declines to recuse himself in a capital case in which he had personally approved the decision to pursue capital punishment against the defendant in his prior capacity as an elected prosecutor, and continued to head the prosecutor's office that defended the death verdict on appeal, and where he had publicly expressed strong support for capital punishment during his judicial election campaign. And 2. Whether the 8th and 14th Amendments are violated by the participation of a potentially biased jurist on a multi-member tribunal deciding a capital case, regardless of whether his vote is ultimately decisive. To discuss the case, we have Cassandra Burke Robertson, who is professor of law, Laura B. Chisholm Distinguished Research Scholar, and director of the Center for Professional Ethics at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Robertson.
Williams v. Pennsylvania is a case about judicial recusal arising out of a death penalty case. Specifically, the Supreme Court must first decide whether the defendant's constitutional due process rights were violated when the same district attorney who approved the decision to seek the death penalty against him then went on, years later, to be elected to the state Supreme Court, and in that capacity ruled against the defendant's claim for post-conviction relief after denying a motion to recuse. Second, if the court decides that the judge was constitutionally disqualified, it then must also decide whether reversal is required when the disqualified judge's vote was not dispositive of the case, when, in fact, the remainder of the court voted unanimously against the petitioner. The underlying case itself, it is both complicated and tragic. The defendant, Terrence Williams, was sexually abused by a number of men starting at age 13. At the ages of 17 and 18, Williams murdered two of those men. In the first case, the district attorney charged Williams with first-degree murder. But after evidence of the abuse was brought forward at trial, the jury convicted Williams only of third-degree murder. The second case, which involved the killing of Amos Norwood, went to trial in 1986. This time, Williams had a new attorney who he met for the first time only on the night before trial. The new attorney did not present evidence of the abuse, and Williams compounded the problem by claiming at trial that he was not involved in the murder, had never met the man before, and had no idea who he was. The jury found Williams guilty of the murder and, finding no mitigating circumstances, sentenced him to death. In post-conviction proceedings, Williams later alleged that his trial counsel had provided ineffective assistance by failing to investigate and present mitigating evidence, including evidence of Norwood's abuse of Williams and other underage boys. There were several rounds of post-conviction proceedings, but in 2012, decades after the original sentencing, the state court found that the prosecutor's office had in fact withheld evidence of Norwood's sexual abuse of other teenage boys in violation of Brady v. Maryland, and the court therefore vacated Williams' death sentence. Now, as an aside, in describing these underlying facts, the Commonwealth's briefing in the Supreme Court was sharply critical of the judge's decision to vacate the death penalty, and especially critical of the judge's characterization of Williams as a victim of sexual abuse, when, in the Commonwealth's phrasing, he was a, quote, double murderer who had sex with men for money. Given that Williams was between the ages of 13 and 17 when the sexual contact occurred, and therefore legally incapable of consent, the Commonwealth's portrayal of Williams as responsible for his own sexual abuse seems both jarring and counterproductive, especially when the Commonwealth could easily have emphasized only that childhood abuse does not justify later murder. At any rate, after the post-conviction judge stayed Williams' execution, the Commonwealth then filed an emergency application for relief with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, seeking to vacate this ruling. This is where the recusal issues came into play. At the time of Williams' trial in 1986, Ronald Castile had recently been elected district attorney. In that role, he reviewed his staff's recommendations about whether to seek the death penalty. He had reviewed the Williams case at that time, making a handwritten note in the file that said, quote, "Approved to proceed on the death penalty, signed Ronald Castile." In the intervening years, Castile ran for judicial office, and by 2012, he was serving as Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. His election platform had emphasized his prosecutorial experience, and he was quoted as saying, "I sent 45 people to death row as District Attorney of Philadelphia." Given Castile's earlier participation in the case against Williams, Williams' attorney filed a recusal motion. However, because of the amount of time that had passed, and the fact that he had not served as trial attorney or otherwise taken a larger role in the case, Chief Justice Castile denied the motion. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court then unanimously ordered the lower court's ruling to be vacated, reinstating the death sentence. The court concluded that Williams, at least, certainly knew of Norwood's sexual abuse of him and stated that he, quote, could have used his prior knowledge and his counsel's due diligence to obtain additional information and witnesses to support a different trial theory than that prevented, but that Williams had instead chosen to present a perjured strategy of complete denial of involvement in the murder. The question now before the United States Supreme Court is whether Chief Justice Castile's denial of the recusal motion amounts to a denial of constitutional due process. There's no question that the Code of Judicial Conduct requires judicial recusal when a judge has previously served as counsel in the case. As the amicus brief from the American Bar Association points out, every state has adopted this rule, and there is at least no textual exception for the passage of time in cases that continue for decades. But of course, it's up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to interpret the state's Code of Judicial Conduct, so the only question for the Supreme Court to decide is whether the due process guarantee of the United States Constitution also requires recusal in this instance. The court last dealt with the question of due process recusal in the 2009 case of Caperton versus Massey, where the court held that constitutional due process requires judicial recusal when the objective circumstance of the case suggests a probability of actual bias. And the court held that a disproportionately large campaign contribution created such a circumstance in Caperton. In dissent, Chief Justice Roberts warned that the court's Caperton ruling created a vague standard that he described as, quote, inherently boundless. His dissent posed 40 different questions about the unresolved scope of the opinion, including a question about whether the judge's vote must, in fact, be outcome determinative. Because the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was unanimous in the Williams case, that question now takes on much greater immediacy. Oral argument before the Supreme Court in the Williams case appeared in many ways to be a sequel to Caperton, but now set in the criminal justice context rather than in civil litigation. Justice Alito pointed out the key issue early on, saying that the problem that is presented by this case is where the constitutional line is going to be drawn. The unusual posture of this case allowed Williams' counsel to offer a relatively narrow test. He argued that due process requires a prosecutor-turned-judge to recuse when the prosecutor has direct personal involvement in a substantial decision in the case, and the issue before the court reflects upon that decision. As the argument progressed, however, counsel at times expressed support for a broader standard that would also require recusal even when the judge had merely supervised the prosecutor's office without directly participating in the case, causing Justice Kagan to state at one point that she was unclear as to the precise rule that counsel was advocating for. During the argument, Justice Breyer also noted that he was concerned that any rule adopted by the court to address the fact of this particular case creates a risk of a potential flood of recusal issues in cases where judges have prior governmental experience, which is an extremely common occurrence. The Commonwealth Council, in argument, recommended a flexible totality of the circumstances test that would not require recusal when the judge's earlier involvement was both limited in scope and distant in time. Justice Alito continued to express frustration with the open-ended nature of such an inquiry, and he, like the other justices, seemed to be pushing the advocates to articulate potential limiting principles. The Commonwealth Council, however, noted that Caperton's open-ended approach to the constitutional inquiry prevented the easy application of a bright-line constitutional rule on recusal, which made it difficult to identify potential limits. Finally, the justices had a number of questions for both parties about the potential remedy. Justice Kennedy raised the possibility that the failure to recuse could essentially be harmless error, given that Justice Castile's vote was not dispositive and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was unanimous in its ruling. Williams's briefing, as well as several of the amicus briefs, delved deeply into the social science literature on group decision-making, arguing that such research has consistently shown that groups are influenced by individual members, and that the influence can happen even at an unconscious level, thus potentially tainting the entire group and, in Williams' view, requiring rehearing. The justices pointed out at argument that this creates a very difficult question on remand. If the case is sent back to the panel that was already tainted by these collegial discussions with a potentially biased member, then why wouldn't the remaining panel still be suffering from that earlier influence when they reconsider the case in the absence of that biased member? In this case, Williams' counsel was comfortable asking for a remand because three of the seven judges had turned over on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court since the earlier ruling, so the court's makeup would be significantly different on remand. In other cases, however, this would be a much more significant issue. Most observers expect that the court will likely rule in favor of Williams, probably in a relatively narrow opinion. A number of amicus briefs were filed in support of the petitioner, but none were filed in support of the Commonwealth, not even from the other states. And it may be that the egregious facts of this particular case made the non-recusal decision a difficult one to defend. Even the amicus brief filed by 16 former judges with prosecutorial experience, who might have been expected to argue against a constitutional requirement and in favor of greater judicial discretion, instead agreed with the petitioner that due process requires the recusal of judges who participated in the underlying prosecution. If the court indeed rules in favor of the petitioner, that decision may very well be Caperton 2.0, a narrow ruling that disposes of a very troubling case, but without giving significant guidance for the future.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.